Hello, fellow adventurers. I'm Erica, and welcome to the Adventure On podcast, a place where we share stories of self-discovery and lessons learned both on and off the trail.
Welcome back, everyone. This week, I have my friend Deanne joining me from Colorado. I'm super excited to have her here to tell us all about her journeys in the great outdoors. So welcome.
Thanks so much, Erica, for having me.
I'm super excited to talk about the goals that you set last year and all of your adventures this year. But why don't you tell me a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Kansas. And my first introduction to the West in the U.S. is through grad school. I went to school in Fort Collins and I got my master's in civil environmental engineering, where I focused on wastewater treatment. And currently I'm a wastewater treatment engineer in Denver. Basically what that means is everybody has to flush their toilet, everybody uses the sink, everybody showers, and someone has to figure out how we clean that water so that way it doesn't pollute our environment. And we can put it back into the water cycle and eventually get it to drinking water standards again. So I kind of work on a day-to-day basis on the detailed design of how do we get our plants to treat the dirty water, primarily with utilities in different cities to treat the water in different places.
That's such a unique job. I mean, like when you go to career day or whatever, you talk to little kids, like, no one really says, I'm going to be a wastewater treatment engineer person, right? Like, how'd you get into that?
Yeah, so it is unique because I think a lot of people don't think about it, probably because it's out of sight, out of mind. People, you know, just flush their toilet and they move on with the rest of their day. And every time I flush the toilet, I'm thinking about where this is going. So I got into wastewater, well, environmental engineering in general through my volunteer work with Engineers Without Borders back at Kansas State University, where I did my undergrad. And I was really fortunate enough to go to various different countries while I was in undergrad. The first country I went to was India, and I spent 2 weeks there doing an assessment trip. And my mom is from the Philippines, so I had a pretty unique perspective growing up because we'd go visit family overseas, and I got to see kind of like third world conditions at a really young age. And so I knew that I wanted to do something in a capacity where I could help people. I didn't really know what that was until I went to India. And I just saw how dire some of these places are that people live and just how important health and sanitation and access to clean water really is. And if you don't have that, you don't really have much in your life. And, one of the things that I learned through my experience with Engineers Without Borders is that wastewater treatment is the most energy intensive process of any city in the world, because to transport water, especially with solids in it, like sludge and other waste products, you know, it requires a lot of power to do that. And so I thought, well, if I can pursue a career where I'm helping people, you know, I'll feel fulfilled. If I can also pursue a career that helps the environment, that's extremely fulfilling as well. And, you know, if I can do this in an industry that has a pretty significant footprint, like carbon footprint, like the wastewater industry, then that's probably the direction that I would go, that I should go, and I'd be really happy with my career. So, yeah, this all kind of started just visiting family overseas. And then, I think that international experience was something that was part of what made Engineers Without Borders very attractive to me, because I could go to different countries and, you know, it wasn't like I was working on a project and I would never see it come to fruition. You know, I got to, throughout my entire college experience, I got to work on actual problems affecting people. And then I got to go to their communities and actually implement some of these ideas that the team and I had to make their lives better, so that way they'd have better access to clean water and improved hygiene. And one thing that's not directly related to wastewater, but my Engineers Without Borders experience, is I had a senior design project, and the community we went to in Ecuador, they had a plastic waste issue. And this little community that we went to is called Yacuñay. There's about 80 people. It's in the Andes Mountains, and they don't have trash pickup like you would see here in the US. So they are left with either burning or burying their trash. And this community was run by a group of older men, and that was kind of like their council. They had a president and a vice president and so on. And the president realized that whenever the women would burn their plastic trash in their thatched roof, non-ventilated huts, that they would cough a lot. And so when we were there, he had said, hey, can you help us with this plastic problem? Because I don't think it's healthy. You know, everybody seems to be getting sick or coughing a lot. Mm. And I don't want to ruin our pristine mountains by, you know, burying all this trash. So the first year when we were there and he presented this problem to us, we were working on a water distribution system for the community. So they had a tank kind of at the top of the mountain, and then they had PVC piping that would distribute the water to the different homes as it flowed down the mountain. So it was just a gravity fed system. And we worked on that. We were able to retrofit that system and give people the clean water that they needed. We also installed meters. That way we could keep track of the water usage, and then the community would pay for their water usage, and that money would go back into the system to help repair it. So it was a really sustainable design that we worked with them on. But while we were there, he presented this plastic waste problem. So the team and I spent an entire year figuring out how we were going to help them with their plastic waste issues. And they also needed a daycare. So we thought, why don't we use this as a building material? You know, like instead of bricks, maybe we could use plastic bottles. And we didn't find a lot of literature on this. And clearly there's no engineering standards. This is not a common practice for construction. So the team and I spent a lot of late nights in the construction science lab, and we did a lot of design work and also communicated with the community while we were doing this. And after a year, we went back and we taught them how to use plastic bottles as a building material to construct a daycare that they needed. So that way the women could work in the fields and they wouldn't have to carry babies on their back. You know, they would actually have a safe place for their kids in their community. So like I said, not water related, but something that I thought was really cool experience to be able to do.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, you touch on so many important things. I think that especially in the US, I know this isn't true for everywhere, but like, I feel like clean water gets taken for granted. Like it's fairly accessible, or even like, I think it's France, I want to say, has those like, you know how like when you go to the airport or anywhere and like you can fill your water bottle up in those like little water dispenser things. I think France is the, if I'm remembering correctly, has them all over the city. Like you can just come and get clean water whenever you want. And that's not true for everywhere. So really incredible to hear how you personally have seen and witnessed this and how you can problem solve it. Like it doesn't have to be so inaccessible. We can make it sustainable. We can make it work for the communities that need it. So I love that. And also this other side of things where like taking waste, like plastic bottles and stuff like that, and making it a valuable resource, learning how to make a daycare out of it. That's incredible. I want to like, my brain is like, I need to Google pictures of this now.
I'll send you, I made a YouTube video, you know, back whenever we finished the daycare, and I'll send you a link to it. But, you know, that whole experience was really moving for me personally, because yeah. You know, we were helping people directly just with our own volunteer time. I mean, we took 2 weeks over spring break to go there and do this work. And the fact that the community was really receptive, I think was just incredible, because that's going to help the sustainability mm-hmm. of the project. I think that was also the first time I'd really ever been in the mountains.
Oh, really?
Right. Yeah. And so that was my senior year of college. So I was like 22, and that was the first time I'd ever really actually been in the mountains. I mean, we had driven through them as a kid, like going to California from Kansas, but I mean, I was up there hiking, hauling up material, you know, really getting in the dirt to build these projects that we're working on. And I want to say that had a pretty big impact in me, like subconsciously, mm-hmm. because I had no other experience with the mountains, but I knew that I loved them after that trip. after those two trips up there to the Andes.
Yeah, I can imagine that, especially there, like in the Andes, like what an incredible place to be completely surrounded by mountains, not only having this really powerful experience with Engineers Without Borders, but like in the outdoors, like you physically being outdoors. So you mentioned like going to California from Kansas. Did you grow up going outside a lot?
Nothing outside of just riding my bike around the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. My family isn't the type that's gonna take a summer trip camping or backpacking, or, you know, we didn't really spend much time outside of cities whenever we did go on vacation. It was just pretty casual, you know, you're pretty standard. Let's go take a road trip, go to the zoo, hang out with, mm-hmm. you know, distant relatives type of thing. My mom is extremely afraid of heights. So she didn't even like driving through the mountains, let alone go hike through them. I think she would have been really scared.
Oh, totally. So you go have this incredibly powerful experience in the Andes, and then you moved to Colorado right after that?
So I graduated and I actually took a job in oil and gas. And like, here's my story with going into oil and gas in Houston, Texas.
You went to Texas for this too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'm excited for this story. All right, let's hear it.
So in college, I was part of a bunch of different organizations like Engineers Without Borders. I was also part of Students for Environmental Action. And SEA is a type of organization that really tries to advocate for the environment. And I had this idea, this very naive idea in college, that what if I tried to be a change agent from within? So instead of just, you know, being the person that's always protesting or campaigning, what would happen if I went into the oil and gas industry and tried to make a difference there? You know, maybe somehow with time and patience and with talking to the right people, maybe I could make a change. So I went in as an environmental engineer, specifically to treat water and wastewater that had been contaminated from different chemical and oil and gas processes. And I thought, you know, maybe this is the right direction I should go. And the company that I was with was transitioning leadership to a new CEO whose vision was sustainability. So I thought, man, this is like the perfect time to join the company. Him and I have the same mindset. You know, maybe this is going to be a good thing. Well, I learned that sustainability has many different definitions, depending on who you ask. And it could have a business context. So it could be, how do we get repeat clients? How do we build a sustainable business model? And not necessarily, how do we implement sustainable processes that protect our environment?
Yeah.
And within my 3 years of being in oil and gas, I did learn a lot of really valuable technical engineering principles, and I gained a lot of experience that I've been able to use throughout my career. But there were some very tough moral and ethical challenges that I had to face.
Yeah.
And ultimately, those are what drove me away from this naive idea I had at the very beginning. I mean, I was having discussions with clients who were making decisions that I just couldn't get behind.
Yeah.
And so it was really tough for me because I was earning a good paycheck. You know, I was kind of set financially and career-wise. And I mean, I even got to work abroad in London for 6 months. And like career-wise, I had a very stable position, but I was having trouble sleeping at night and I really couldn't justify the paycheck I was getting. And so there was a point where I was thinking, I need to get back to why I went to environmental engineering, why I studied this in the first place. And so I ended up applying to go to grad schools. And that's when I ended up winning a fellowship that paid for my grad school. And that's how I ended up going to Colorado and pursuing my master's here.
Oh, awesome. That's incredible. And it sounds like you were able to find a career or a company or like a place to work that more aligned with those ethics and values.
Yeah, absolutely. So I did 2 years of my master's specifically on wastewater treatment design. I did a lot of lab work and I ended up finding the firm that I work for now, who strictly does water, wastewater type of work. We don't do any other consulting work for any other industries. And so I'm able to be really specialized in my area. And I mean, I'm serving communities that, you know, we need to have clean water wherever we go. So that to me is really important. Plus it's here, you know, it brought me back to Colorado, which I love it here.
Oh yeah. I can only imagine how much is just right out your front door living there. So I follow you on Instagram and I see a lot of your outdoor adventures. When did that passion about not just bringing safe water and helping people create sustainable spaces to live and exist, but when did that become kind of a passion of your own to explore?
Yeah. So when I moved out here, as I mentioned, my really only experience was those few weeks in the Andes Mountains. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I came out here and I was intimidated. I didn't know, you know, I'd hear people say trailhead and I didn't even know what a trailhead was. People would say, hey, I'm going to the mountains. And I'm like, what do you Google? The mountains? Like, how do you know where to go? And I was so lost. I mean, I didn't know apps existed like AllTrails. And I was just completely clueless as to where to even begin. Like, what do you even pack to go somewhere? And how do you even know where you want to go? You know, how do you do this research? And, you know, when I started grad school, I was 26. And a lot of the grad students that I studied with were kind of these like book nerds. Like they didn't go out and hike. And I didn't know many undergrads at the time. And so I just kind of was lost, really. And I didn't have a roommate or anything. But I decided to reactivate my social media when I got to grad school. And I found this outdoor club at school. And they were going to take people up to Rocky Mountain National Park. And that was kind of my segue into, you know, how do you know where to go? What do these terms mean? Like, what do you pack? And the girl who led that trip was really great because I asked her a ton of questions and she was able to kind of point me in the right direction. And then that outdoor club also helped me because I got to meet other people who share the same excitement for going outside and exploring. I remember when I went on my first hike by myself, I figured out you can Google Rocky Mountain National Park and I figured out how to get there. And I remember thinking, I'm really scared to drive in the mountains because it might be snowy. It might be icy. What if I spin out of control? You know, I'm by myself. My phone doesn't really have service up in the mountains. And I had all these doubts and fears. And I just kind of told myself, well, either you're going to do it or you're not. Everybody that you talked to said, it's not that big of a deal. You're going to be fine. So maybe you should just trust them. And I went hiking to Bear Lake, Nymph, Dream, and Emerald, kind of the classic route, pretty easy, not too much elevation gain. And I remember feeling extremely empowered after that. You know, I was safe and I had fun. And I think that alone, having gone by myself, really helped me to just build confidence to keep going.
Yeah, I feel like this is such an important thing to talk about because it can be incredibly intimidating getting outside and not knowing where to start. And like, what is a trailhead? What does that mean? How do I get there? How do I know when I'm on the trail where to go? And I love that you were able to find kind of like a group in a community, because I think that's really the best place to start, is finding a local community of people that are getting outside that you can learn from and kind of embrace that beginner's mindset with.
Absolutely. And I would say, you know, anybody who's listening, if you're kind of in the spot where I was a few years ago, where you don't know anything and, you know, you may feel embarrassed to even ask a question because it's such commonplace for other people that you know or that you're talking to. I would say probably the best thing to do is to use social media to your advantage. I mean, if I hadn't reactivated my Facebook, I wouldn't have found that group that was on campus. And I was on campus every single day, but I wouldn't have found them if it weren't for social media. And I think nowadays there's so many people who are excited about the outdoors, that you can really find some good information out there, either from somebody you follow, or there might be a group. I know here in Colorado, there's a Colorado 14ers page. You can, it's like an open forum, and there's always people willing to help and share information. Yeah. And, you know, you can learn a lot through just different groups online.
Oh, totally. And most of these groups are free of charge. Like, for example, I'm trying to refine some of my canyoneering skills, and there's a group locally that has like classes on Thursday night. And so like this Thursday, I'm going to a class that's all about like how to rig up different types of anchor systems. There are so many resources out there, and it can be intimidating to go to a group when you don't know anybody for sure. That's not everyone's cup of tea, but I think it's super awesome that there are those resources, usually free of charge, available to anyone that wants to give it a try.
Absolutely. I don't think I've paid for any forum or any membership mm-hmm. in this whole time since I've started hiking in Colorado. Everything's been through things I've learned online or through people I've met or through my friends.
Well, in social media and like getting advice from random people on the internet can always be like a hit and a miss. Mm-hmm. So I want to preface, like, for those listening, definitely do more research instead of just listening to one person, listen to several. Like if you follow like three or four different pages, cross-reference things. Flash forward, I don't know, however many years, you completed your goal of hiking a 14er a month in 2021. So I want to hear all about that.
Yeah. So I came to Colorado in 2016, didn't know anything about hiking, didn't know what a cairn was. And then 5 years later, I had this ambitious goal of hiking a 14er each month. And before my goal, I had hiked a few 14ers, but it was in the summer, so longer days, pretty moderate weather. You know, I didn't have to worry about road conditions or closed trailheads or snow and ice or extreme winds. And what kind of started this goal was in December of 2020, I met up with a friend and I said, you know, let's try to hike Mount Quandary, which is a 14er here outside of Breckenridge. And we had abnormally good conditions for December. There was no wind. It was really warm, but it was my introduction to winter 14ers. And I thought, well, I'm sure it's not always going to be like this, but
right.
You know, if I play my cards right, I might actually be able to do some more of these in the winter. And one thing that was really unique about that hike was, so my friend who I went hiking with is pretty experienced, but he did not bring micro spikes, and he was having a hard time hiking because his feet kept slipping. It ended up kind of worsening a hip injury that he had. And so at the base, there's kind of this very steep part right before you get to the summit. So my friend decided he was going to tap out. And because the weather was good, I said, you know, I'll hurry up and run up the mountain while you wait down here, and I'll, you know, come back down quickly. And I'm really glad I did that, because we had talked about just turning around, and I'm really stubborn about turning around unless I absolutely need to, or unless, you know, someone else in my party is like severely injured and like needs to turn around. Mm-hmm. In this case, like I said, his injury wasn't so severe that he needed medical attention, and the weather conditions were good enough that he was comfortable waiting. So I ended up going up to the top by myself, and I met a friend there who I was just like, hey, can you take my picture at the top? And for some reason I was like, I should ask her if she is on Instagram. And sure enough, she was, and we got connected, and she's been one of my best hiking buddies since then. And we just met totally organically on the summit, and we've hiked several peaks together, 14ers together, hopefully going to have some plans this summer together. So anyway, this is December of 2020. And also, you know, still in the pandemic, we don't have a vaccine. People are still kind of like scared to be around each other. So it was awesome to meet her, and to meet her so randomly doing something that we both like. So after this hike on Quandary, because I had such a good experience and I felt like I had a new hiking buddy, I just had this crazy idea of like, why don't I just try to do this once a month? Let's just see how this goes. So in January of 2021, that same girl that I met on the summit, we did a 14er together.
And this is so awesome.
Yeah, it's like, it's funny because, well, we did a 13er before the 14er that January, but we had met and we drove up together to the trailhead and she goes, what was your name again? I know your Instagram name, but I don't remember your real name. So that's like how little we knew of each other. And, you know, anybody who's listening to this, I would say, yes, you know, it's great to meet people. Also, just use your best judgment, trust your instincts. If you're getting weird vibes from someone and you don't feel comfortable, then don't hike with them. I felt comfortable around her. I trusted her, felt, you know, like she was a safe person. And, you know, it turned out I was right. Mm-hmm. But, it, you know, it could also end badly.
Yeah, you definitely don't want to just meet random strangers on the internet without like checking in on them first and tuning into your gut, I think is really important. I've met a lot of people and climbed with them from the internet, and I've had both really awesome and not so awesome experiences. So definitely smart to trust your instincts and do what you feel is safest for you.
Absolutely. And that extends to people who, you know, are your friends or maybe acquaintances of acquaintances. I've had good experiences and I've also had some really scary experiences. So you just have to, you have to trust your gut and you have to decide what's your threshold for, you know, deciding if someone is overshooting their capabilities or if they're around the same level as you. So back to the 14er. So January, my friend and I, we did Mount Yale and it was a great hike. We didn't have any weather problems. I think it was actually hotter on the mountain than it was in Denver, which
is wild, because when you are saying I'm going to hike a 14er every month of the year, I'm like, dang, that's got to be gnarly in the winter months, right? Like 14,000 feet is high. Yeah. And that snowpack has to be pretty dense for you to get up there.
Yeah, the snowpack was definitely dense. When we did Mount Yale in January of 2021, we did not need snowshoes. We had spikes and that was sufficient. I think the snow had just like iced over enough. So it was hard when we were hiking.
Did you bring like any avalanche gear or anything like that with you?
We both have a Garmin inReach.
Okay.
So that's probably the closest thing we have to avalanche gear. The avalanche, we did look at, well, me and whoever I was with, we did look at the avalanche. There's a website in Colorado, I'm blanking right now, but we did look at the Avy danger before each hike, which is actually a really good point to bring up because that's extremely important in Colorado or like anywhere you're hiking where there's snow.
Oh yeah.
So month one was pretty smooth sailing. I mean, there's this section called 1,000 Foot of Suck. And yeah, it sucks. It's very steep, but you know, we made it and it took the whole day and it was fine. And I was like, you know what, maybe this goal isn't as hard as I think it's going to be. And then I just got like way too confident and February came. And February, in my opinion, for this whole year long goal was the hardest hike due to weather, hands down.
Oh yeah.
So I went hiking with another friend I'd met in grad school, and he had never done a 14er in his life. The weekend before we were going to do this 14er, him and I went snowshoeing. I just really wanted to gauge, you know, where he was in terms of his physical capabilities and kind of his risk tolerance. Mm-hmm. And we actually didn't make it very far that snowshoeing trip. He wanted to turn around. He was getting pretty fatigued. And so that at least helped me gauge, you know, how far I thought we might get when we did the 14er for February, which was Mount Bierstadt. And anybody who's from Colorado or hikes 14ers here, they'll pretty much say like Bierstadt's an easy 14er. And I used to be one of those people that said that. And then I went and hiked Bierstadt on February 27th of 2021. And I am reluctant to say any 14er is easy, because the weather can really just make it one of the most difficult hikes of your life. So my friend and I, you know, we decided we were going to do this. And, you know, I had kind of low expectations that we would summit just because of how the snowshoeing trip went. the weekend before, and I looked at the weather, and the weather looked pretty bad. I'm not going to lie. But I thought, you know what, let's just go for it. Let's just see what happens. So the weather called for 55 mile per hour winds and negative 46 Fahrenheit wind chill.
And you still were like, okay, yeah, doable.
And I was like, you know, full disclosure, I told my friend, I said, look, this is what, you know, we're going to be dealing with. And given how the snowshoeing trip went the weekend before, I'm not expecting us to summit. And, you know, I felt like, well, I don't have that much to lose because I've only got 1 month down out of 12. Mm-hmm. So if we don't summit this month, you know, it's like, well, then I'll just have it for a goal next year. Well, we got to the trailhead and there was another car that pulled up with four other younger guys, and they'll come into the story later. So my friend and I, we start hiking, and usually once I get hiking, I warm up. Mm-hmm. But this day, I was hiking for a good hour and a half and I was still cold.
Oh boy.
Like the bottom half of me was cold. My core was fine. My head was fine, but my legs, like my hip down, just bone cold. So we keep hiking and we get to, I want to say probably about halfway to the summit. And there's like this blizzard type condition that just rolls in on us, and we can't see our footprints anymore. I get so disoriented because I can't see the summit. I can't see anything around me. I can't see the cairns that we just passed. And so I told my friend, I said, hey, let's sit down and let's talk about this and see if we should keep going, because I don't really feel safe. You know, you've never mm-hmm. done a 14er. It's hard for you to really gauge what the weather can be like up here.
Well, and I feel like that's a smart thing to do, is to press pause and reevaluate the situation.
Yeah. And he's like, well, you have a Garmin, we're fine. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, a helicopter is not going to come and get us if they can't safely get to us.
Oh yeah.
You know, their number one priority is to keep the responder safe, not to rescue us.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I really don't feel comfortable. We need to turn around. And I could tell he was disappointed. But we did turn around. Well, that group of four young guys wasn't too far behind us. And my friend said, well, why don't we see what they're up to, what they're going to keep going? And I said, well, it doesn't really matter what they're going to do. They're not in our group. You know, what matters is what we decide, not what they decide. So he didn't care. And he asked them if they were going to keep going. They look like they might have been like 19 or 20 years old, very young, also inexperienced. Well, they decided they were going to keep going towards the summit. So my friend said, well, hey, these four guys are going to go. We should turn back around and head towards the summit. I'm still cold. I'm still uncomfortable. I still have a bad feeling about this.
Yeah. This sounds like one of those movie documentaries, like things that go wrong outside in the making.
Yeah. So I said, well, you know, I kept trying to convince him, you know, we already turned around. Let's just keep going back to the car. He didn't really care. And so he turned around and started to go back towards the summit. The weather had cleared up just enough that we could at least see the summit again. Mm-hmm. But I just had such a bad feeling about this. And I was talking to this group of guys and I said, how many 14ers have you done? Have you hiked in these conditions? And I come to find out one of the guys had just flew in the night before from Vegas.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, and these guys had done four 14ers and none of them had hiked in these types of conditions. So I felt like I was just outnumbered, but also with a bunch of really inexperienced people. And, you know, I had more 14ers under my belt than these guys collectively. And yet I was the one who was not being heard in this decision. So I decided, well, I don't really want to hike down by myself. Plus my friend, who's now like way ahead, has the car keys. So I ended up going back like towards the summit. And, you know, we kept hiking and, you know, we didn't bring snowshoes. And of course, like we're post-holing. And eventually we get to the summit and it is just, it's windy. It's cold. You know, I mentioned the weather, you know, conditions earlier, and that's what it was at the summit. So, so cold and windy. My eyelashes were frozen. I felt like I was going to get frostbite on my fingers. Wow. And, you know, we got to the summit and of course, like we're going to descend and my friend was like, hey, I need some water. I'm out. Well, I tried to give him mine, but my water bottle had frozen. Like all of our water was frozen. So we didn't even have anything to drink. And then finally he starts to get sluggish and he's like, man, I'm really tired. And I was like, yeah, that's how I felt hours ago when I tried to tell you we needed to get back to the car. And so I think, you know, the big lesson for me from that was I just needed to do a better job of picking who I'm hiking with. I mean, this was somebody I was familiar with. This was a friend. And yet he, you know, made decisions that made me feel uncomfortable. And I mean, I think to this day, I still feel extremely lucky that we didn't have to get rescued because
it sounds like it was a really lucky experience. Like, I'm sure there are people that'll listen to this and be like, oh yeah, see, nothing bad happened. But just because nothing bad happens doesn't mean that like it was a safe experience.
Yeah. And I mean, this was on a Saturday and him and I had a whole weekend planned. We were trying to do as much as we could in one weekend. And we still had other activities like in Southern Colorado that we were going to do. And it was kind of hard to sit next to him on this pretty long road trip because I kept thinking he made a decision that wasn't very respectful. Just like didn't take into consideration, you know, where I was physically. So we endured that mountain. And then the next month I did Mount Elbert with my friend. Nice. I did Yale with. That was a pretty non-eventful hike. And then I ended up doing Quandary again in April. And that was my first solo 14er summit. So
oh, rad.
Yeah, that was really exciting because I mean, I was familiar with Quandary. So mm-hmm. You know, I didn't think I would get lost. And it's a pretty popular trail that if you need help, you'll most likely run into somebody. But it was just, it felt like an achievement to be able to go by myself and do this. Not long after that summit, I ended up getting COVID. And I thought, this is it. Yeah, I was like, this is it. I got COVID. I was really fatigued when I had it and had lost my sense of taste and smell. And I thought, well, this is it. My goal is done. I don't know if I'm going to be able to summit with having got this, especially because I have asthma. And so when I had COVID, I wasn't sure, you know, if I was going to have to go to the hospital or what the case was.
Well, especially during like fairly, I guess by then it's about the middle of all of the stuff that's happening. Like COVID's been around for a little while, but there's still so many unknowns. Like, how is this going to affect me long-term? I'm sure there was a lot of questions running through your head related to being able to accomplish this goal.
Yeah, I was having such a hard time that going up and down the stairs in my place was draining.
Mm.
And I thought, if I can't even go up a flight of stairs, there's no way I'm going to be able to hike another mountain. You know, I mean, but that was kind of the last thing on my mind. I was just hoping that I wasn't going to die alone in my apartment with my cat.
Yeah. You know,
That was where my priorities were. I was just thinking, like, I hope I'm going to be okay. You know, I hope I'm going to recover. Yeah. I'm not going to have long-term COVID. My goal kind of just went out the window at that point. But I'm very fortunate that I didn't have to go to the hospital. The worst symptom I had was fatigue. I regained my smell and taste back. And in May, I ended up hiking Mount Sherman. And I was just so surprised that I could even do that. When just a few weeks before I couldn't even walk up the stairs without being out of breath. So, and then in June we did Mount Huron and in July we did my favorite Snuffles. We did a backpacking trip to the Blue Lakes just outside of Telluride.
Oh,
and we ended up hiking my second class 3 and it's just an incredible view from the top. You can see in all different directions, you can see lakes and they're really deep blue. And this was before all the wildfire smoke had like come into the state. So we were really lucky to be out there when we were. It's a pretty short hike, but it is incredibly steep. And there's a section where there's a lot of loose rock and kind of loose big boulders. And mm-hmm. so that's really the biggest danger, is that when people who are higher than you in elevation are hiking, they can end up pushing rock down or even boulders. And so you just have to be really careful about being aware of your surroundings.
Yeah, for sure.
And even when we went there, there's like a second segment that's kind of like a narrow chute that you have to go up if you take the standard route, that was still covered in snow and ice, even in July. And one thing that's worth noting, and this was actually an unfortunate event, is the day before we hiked the Mount Sneffels, there was an older gentleman who was climbing in that area and had an accident, and his body was recovered the morning that we were doing this.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, as we're hiking, I see this helicopter, and I'm like, helicopters are always bad news. You know, so there's either a fire or like someone's injured or being recovered. And we could hear the response team's walkie-talkies. And after talking to them, they were, you know, they were sad to say that they were doing a body recovery. And so, you know, here I am really excited to go. And he was even more nervous now that, you know, somebody's being recovered where we're about to go. And so I kind of had to be more patient and just kind of talk him through, like, hey, you know, if you absolutely feel like you can't do this, you know, we can always turn around. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously we want to have fun. We don't want anybody to be totally miserable, because then it kind of takes away from the whole experience.
Well, and I think that's like such an important part of hiking with anybody, is that communication, and that it's like you were giving the respect that you weren't given on that second mountain, where, hey, if you are feeling like this isn't a good idea, okay, let's collaborate. Let's work together. We're in this as a team. If one of us doesn't feel comfortable, we can turn around and come back a different day. This mountain's always going to be here. I think that's so important.
Yeah. It also really helps the other person build mm-hmm. confidence, not just with you, but also, you know, with themselves. I think if you're already feeling nervous and someone's pressuring you, you're going to feel even more insecure or more nervous about going.
Totally.
So after having a solid talk about, you know, do we want to keep moving forward? We did. And we had checkpoints along the way where we kept saying, okay, are we good? Are we good to keep going? Or do you want to turn around? And we eventually made it to the summit, and it was the most beautiful summit I did that whole year. And then it was nice to hike down to camp and just be at the lake afterwards. And then, so that was July. And then in August, we did La Plata. And the interesting thing that I remember about La Plata was it's kind of a popular hike. And I think a lot of people underestimated that they could figure out where the trailhead was. So the morning that we were going to go hike, we saw three groups of people who were going in the direction where we just came from. And I'm a pretty social person, and I usually just like to talk to people. And, you know, I was just curious about where these people were going. Maybe they knew something we didn't know. And I'm glad I asked each group, hey, where are you guys going? Because all of them said they were going to the La Plata trailhead. And it turns out they were lost. they didn't even have the map downloaded. They didn't have the trail downloaded, because they assumed that since it's such a popular trail, you know, they could find their way. And so we ended up telling them, hey, actually the trailhead's over this way, like a mile this way. And they had just passed it on the road, because the sign is pretty hidden. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think the big lesson from La Plata is to always download the map. Doesn't matter how popular or how confident you are with the route, especially if you haven't done it before. It's just good to have.
Good to have for sure.
And then September, I did Mount Belford. We were supposed to do Harvard, but our car couldn't make it up to the trailhead. So we just had to adjust plans that morning and ended up doing Belford, which is kind of a nice trail to do in the summer, because Missouri is next to Belford and Oxford is a mile. Well, it's 2 miles round trip from Belford. So if you're feeling super ambitious, you could do all three in a day.
Oh, awesome.
A lot of elevation gain though. So you need to be ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then after Belford, so part of this goal of mine wasn't to just kind of knock these out. I wanted to do things that were challenging for me. Mm-hmm. So like some of the class 3 type of hikes. And there's 2 14ers next to each other called Gray and Tories. And mm-hmm. you can take Kelso Ridge, which depending on which way you take has class 3, 4, and 5 sections on it. And it's pretty exposed. There's some loose rock along the way. And I had hiked Grays and Tories years ago, but I really wanted to do Kelso Ridge just to challenge myself. And so I found a friend who had done it before because I felt more confident going with somebody who actually had done it.
Yeah, and for sure.
Experienced with like climbing. So you don't, well, at least the route we took, you don't bring climbing gear. It's all kind of just hiking and scrambling. And I remember being on that ridge and thinking, this is a lot. This is kind mm-hmm. of a lot for me because I'm not very sure-footed. I don't regularly climb. So I'm not very comfortable with handholds and foot placements and kind of that level of exposure that I was experiencing. And there's a section on there called the knife edge, mm-hmm. which I thought was going to be the scariest, but it actually wasn't even the worst part of it. I thought the scrambling was a lot scarier, but I remember walking away from that thinking I need to focus more on my climbing skills if I want to continue to do this type of class 3.
Yeah, for sure.
Hikes. So that was kind of the big challenge for me. That was probably my hardest hike in this whole goal, technically. And then for November was really hard. So 3 attempts at a 14er before I finally summited one.
Oh, wow.
So November was like the persistent month. So that first weekend in November, even though we had great weather, we didn't make it to the summit. And we were trying to get up Mount Lincoln via the Wheeler Trailhead, but it was just really steep. I think I just had very low energy that day to take on how steep that mountain was.
Mm-hmm.
So the weekend after, I thought, well, you know, I could do Mount Democrat, which is in that same area. Well, we ran into some pretty crazy weather, not quite as bad as Bierstadt, but this was a hard lesson to learn. He didn't have a good winter layering system. And he actually ended up having early signs of hypothermia on this trail. And, you know, when we were hiking, it was so windy, we couldn't hear each other talk, even though we were pretty close to each other. And so when we were hiking, he was calling out for me and I didn't even know because it was so windy. And in my head, I'm thinking, well, I've hiked in worse. I'm going to keep going.
Right.
And then I turn around and I see him kind of like slouched over. And I'm like, what's going on here? So I go up to him and he's like, I'm cold. I'm soaking wet because I've been sweating through all my layers. And it's windy. It must be like, I don't know, 35, 40 miles per hour winds. Like it's very windy. And so the wind is just piercing through all of his wet layers. And he's like, I can't, like I'm having a hard time breathing. I can't really see clearly. And I was like, okay, we need to turn around. You know, this is not good. So I made sure he got some water in him. And then, you know, he started hiking down and I followed behind. And he's actually a cryptographer. So he takes care of all the maps when we go places. And he was getting lost. That's just how disoriented he was.
Wow.
And, you know, he was fine. He didn't get frostbite. You know, he didn't have to go to the hospital or anything. But we got to the car and he was a little emotional and was like, you know, thank you for listening to me and not pushing me to keep going because I just couldn't keep going. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, you know, I know what it's like when somebody is, you know, not really listening to you, but I also could see that you were not in good shape. You know, I was worried about him.
Yeah.
I was worried that I might have to, you know, carry him or something back to the car. So that was week 2 of November. And on the 3rd week, I really wanted to get this goal, right? So we ended up going back to Democrat and the weather was much, much better. And I ended up summiting and felt like I could finally rest for November. And then in December, I wanted to go back to that same area and do Cameron Peak. And I went with the same friend I did in December of 2020. Oh, we cool. went and did the hike, and we were the only ones up there. It was a lot colder and windier than the forecast had projected it to be. But yeah, made it to the top and felt incredibly relieved to finally finish my goal. So
yeah, that was going to be my question. Like, what did it feel like standing on top of that peak?
You know, it was so cold that it was kind of hard to take it all in. It's not like I could just sit there and just enjoy the summit, because, you know, we basically went up there, took our picture. I had a little Santa Claus dress that I threw on.
Oh,
and then we had to hike down because it was so cold, and you know, we couldn't really feel our fingers and hands anymore. And even when I got home, it was a little, I felt relieved, but it also felt surreal.
Mm.
And I think because of those two failed summits in November, there was a point throughout the back end of my goal where it kind of felt like I was going through the motions and I wasn't having as much, I wasn't enjoying it as much as I did towards the beginning part of my goal. It felt like I was just trying to meet numbers, meet quotas,
mm-hmm.
instead of just, you know, experiencing it for what it was. Right. And so I think looking back, I'm incredibly proud that I managed to overcome all these other little challenges along the way and successfully complete this goal. I think for the next goal, I'm probably going to try to focus more on the experience and not just, you know, am I hitting these check marks?
I love that. I think that is so important. I tend to be the same way with goals, and I've learned over the years that, like, tuning into myself and like, when do I feel like I've completed or that I've met kind of whatever it was that I was searching for out here. So would you say that's the kind of biggest takeaway you had with this whole experience hiking a 14er a month in 2021?
I think the biggest takeaway for me is that when I started out with this goal, I had a lot of doubts, I had a lot of fears, I had a lot of concerns. There were a lot of unknowns. I didn't know if I was going to have a hiking buddy each month. I didn't know if my car was going to spin out on the way to the trailhead and I was going to end up in a ditch somewhere and not be able to hike. I didn't know if I was going to have an injury along the way, or, you know, I didn't know if I was going to recover from COVID or how I was going to recover. So I think all of these fears kind of came out in different ways throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the biggest takeaway is that almost everyone experiences fear. And, you know, there's going to be things that happen that are unpredictable, and they're going to instill some other type of fear in you. And I think what's really important is to just keep your mind on whatever your goal is and work really hard to overcome those fears, whatever it ends up being. You know, if it's hiking alone, or if it's driving in the winter, or if it's doing a new trail that you never thought you could do because it's very technical. You know, I think be smart about it, do your research, do what you need to do to set yourself up for success, but don't cave into your fear. Because, you know, like I said, when I started, I didn't know anything. I didn't know a single thing about how to get outdoors safely. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even throughout this entire process, this entire journey of this, you know, hike a 14er each month, there were still things I didn't know, but I had to figure them out. I also had to learn how to communicate with different types of personalities in order to, you know, make the sound as best the sound decisions as I could.
Totally. And I think it's really important to learn to have a healthy relationship with fear. Like, fear's totally there to keep us safe, like a good portion of the time. And it can also be something that limits us. So stepping outside of that comfort zone it's an incredibly empowering experience to have. And it sounds like that's kind of what you were able to experience in this challenge you set for yourself.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, hiking that, or getting to the summit of Bierstadt when it was 55 mile per hour winds and like negative 46 Fahrenheit. I grew so much in those few hours of hiking than I would have, you know, in probably months of just, you know, hiking a trail with no challenges. Like I said, I feel really lucky that I'm here today and I didn't need rescuing and I didn't get frostbite or lose a limb or something. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, same for the other people that day on the trail. You know, I feel really lucky, but at the same time, I stepped so far outside of my comfort zone that I feel comfortable doing things that I would have never felt comfortable doing had I not had that experience.
Oh, totally. So is that kind of what adventure is to you?
Yeah, I think if I had to define adventure, I think it's spending time doing something where, you know, there's challenge, there's opportunity to grow, obviously having fun, whether that's type 1, 2, or 3, and, you know, having some risk involved. I think the risk component is what makes an adventure different from just a normal outing, in my opinion.
Yeah. I like that. It spices things up a little, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you can learn how to better manage risk, you know, when risk is present. I mean, sometimes you're going to fail, but you're going to learn something from it and you're going to grow. And hopefully the people that are with you are going to do the same.
Oh, beautifully said. It's been a blast. I'm super inspired right now to go hike a 14er.
Yay!
It's like about to start snowing here and there aren't any 14ers.
Well, you and John are always welcome. I'm happy to take you guys around. So
you'll probably be seeing me soon.
Yay!
But if people want to get in touch with you and connect with you and learn more about the ways that they can kind of step outside of that comfort zone and get on the trail, maybe summit some 14ers of their own, where can they find you?
I'm really active on Instagram. So my handle is watertraveler13. My DMs are always open. I have a couple of videos from my 14ers goal. So if you want to check those out and if you have, you know, questions about that, I love to talk about this. So please reach out.
Yeah.
Or if you're in Colorado, I'm in Denver and I would love to get together for a beer or a hike or a bike.
Oh, I love it. And I'll tag all of that in the show notes, so it's easy to find, as well as that video you mentioned earlier from your trip in the Andes. And yeah, thank you so much for joining me today. The time has flown by. I've just loved hearing all of your stories and what an incredible life you've lived so far.
Thanks, Erica. Yeah, I'm really glad that you guys hosted these podcasts and I'm really glad that we made the time to make it happen.
I hope today's episode helped you find the inspiration and courage to get outside and define your own adventure. If you like the podcast, please don't forget to subscribe, follow, and leave a review on whatever platform you're listening on. I'll be back next week with more stories from the trail. Until then, adventure on!